ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today's conversation includes explicit content that may be sensitive for some listeners. It includes references to drug use and extreme self-harm. If you or someone you know needs help, Lifeline is always there for you on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14.
Around 6 years ago, following some crazy impulse, Dominic Gordon took a flying leap off a balcony from an apartment three floors up. He hit the ground hard. The impact broke a whole lot of bones and he was lucky to have survived. Since he was a boy, Dominic's propelled himself into dangerous, risky situations for the sheer hell of it. And now he is trying to swear off that life. He started shoplifting at 10, then it was painting graffiti on moving trains. In his late teens, he moved into taking ice that he'd paid for with stolen cash and going to sex clubs in the city. For Dominic, every day was an opportunity to take insane risks and luxuriate in the excitement and anarchy of it all. After cycling through the same activities for years, Dominic is trying to pull back from all of that and have some semblance of a stable life. He's written a remarkable memoir and it's called Excitable Boy, Essays on Risk. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Richard.
What was the concept of risk to you when you were younger? Did you even know what risk was, or did you have a concept of what risk was?
I guess it's when you're young and when you're a child, it's hard to know. Like you haven't developed that awareness of, okay, what this actually is. It's sort of you're just doing it. And I guess from the age of about probably 7 or 8, which was coincidentally when we moved to the western suburbs with my family, and the environment and everyone around me was just doing similar things. And those things just happened to be, you know, like smoking and lots of exploring and sort of, you know, abandoned, because there was all the schools had closed in the 90s and the exploration was quite in industrial areas and there was not a lot of green, a lot of concrete and... And yeah, the kids were all just kind of doing similar things. And I guess maybe because we were from similar backgrounds and things started young. Yeah, everything started a bit younger. You smoked younger. Even I remember my first patch at high school with Paris.
The name was Paris?
Paris. And we patched under the swing set at the high school. And we were, I think, 10 or 11. So even that, I'm thinking about, it was quite young.
Advanced, yeah.
It's quite young. I didn't know what risk as a concept was, but it was just what everyone was doing and it sort of just gradually picked up steam.
So this is the western suburbs of Melbourne we're talking about, around Yarraville, yes. the suburb of Yarraville, yep. Which is very nicely gentrified these days, but what was it like back then, Dominic?
Very different. So to get perspective, so the house we moved into in Yarraville in about 1993 was actually... That goes back four generations on my dad's side of the family. So when we moved there, that was almost 120 years of one side of my dad's side of the family's home.
All right, so this was like a home. This was really attached to family history.
Yeah, this goes all the way back to like the early part of the 20th century. So when we moved there, it's weirdly like a homecoming for me that I didn't even know existed, and I really took to it. I guess you could say that there was a fair bit of unemployment around. A lot of the working class families and stuff who were sustained by industry and work in the area had sort of all collapsed. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity for young people.
So semi-industrial, slightly
semi-industrial, derelict. There was one cafe and that was just like a weird, like no one even went in there. And there was one like really like knick-knacky boutique shop that sold like berets and yeah, it was... There wasn't a lot there, and there was a lot of that free roam childhood where you could play in the street. And but I mean, look, only two suburbs over was Footscray at the time, and I had friends who lived there, and I'd sort of get the train there at age sort of 10 or 11, and I didn't know what heroin was. I didn't know what, you know, but you would see drug activity and drug-related activity, and you just, it was kind of just normal.
If I think about like my own childhood, the whole suburb I lived in was like a playground. And I can remember me and a bunch of kids, quite young, breaking into the high school gym during the summer and jumping up and down on the trampolines, doing things like that.
Yeah.
So your childhood was like that, just way more extreme.
It's just like that, but just G'd up a bit more. Like it was more... Like, yeah, we did the same thing. We broke into the school. We did like little things like that, but there was always other things going on. There was always like my friend, their family owned a milk bar. He was Turkish. His name was Can. And he would, you know, steal cigarettes from the milk bar, and we took money from the till, and we would go to High Point and play. So it was always like there was the genuine childhood behavior. Then there was just like that little bit extra. Yeah. For example, when I was about 11 years old, I started to go by myself. I don't really know why I did this, but I started to go by myself on the train to the city, just sort of get the train, and I would get a train at about sort of 10 o'clock at night and play games in the city, then come home, and my mum would be so horrified. But from an early age, I liked to be out by myself, at night, kind of roaming around. That's when I started doing the stuff where, you would hold on to the back of trains and do something. They're called back-ons, where you would ride the outside of the train.
You're doing that at 11?
Yeah, 11. Yeah, 11, 12 years old. Because that was when my parents, because I was getting in so much trouble, they didn't want to send me to Williamstown High School, where all my primary school friends went, because I'd been caught shoplifting at High Point, stealing a pair of shorts from Rebel Sport. And they said, because you've done it with this particular kid, all right, we'll take you out of there. We'll send you to a different school altogether to try and change your dynamic and your friendship groups. But I got expelled from there after 1 year, in year seven. That was called Simmons Catholic College.
Right, and you were the guy showing other kids how to shoplift at that stage?
Yeah, well, I took the lead because I was, maybe it was because I was like always like a little kid, quite small, and I was always like just up for things. So you would use your humour and your wit, and we would use your athleticism to sort of, I guess, maybe be popular.
Right, entertain you.
Entertain my classmates. Right. Yeah, and
by doing these audacious things.
Yeah, and that way, that was like early, I guess masculine, semi-masculine traits that would develop into quite poisonous traits later on.
So that's shoplifting. What about stealing, like actually taking cash from places?
Yeah, so that happened at... It's funny, that happened, I guess, at like a transitional phase, maybe when I was about six, probably 16, because I was stealing a lot, just like clothes and other things. I'd leave my house for the day prepared for that. But then what I realized is, like, hang on, if it's based off opportunity and if I'm just roaming around, why not try and get money? And so it turned into that kind of exploration for cash.
And where would you get the cash from?
So I didn't know it at the time, but there's something called searching, which is a type of theft that specifically originates from Sydney. And it's called searching because these kids do it, like you're just hunting for opportunities. And you go, so for example, you might pass a retail store and you'll go into the store and they'll either have a back room where they keep, like there'll either be a safe or there'll be staff belongings. And that back room, depending on where it is, in location within the store, you can sort of time it so that when the people, the workers are distracted, you run in the back, search quickly and run out, and you get whatever you get in that instance. But sometimes, like you can get lucky. I went through a pub one time and I got to the upstairs part where there was nobody and the office was there and the safe was open and I got money from the safe. And sometimes you get a few thousand dollars sometimes if you're lucky, other times a few hundred. But and once I started doing that, I was like, oh, this is proper crime. And I thought I was like, because I wanted to be a criminal from quite a young age.
Really? So
yeah.
You thought, oh, this is proper crime, but this wasn't like a cautionary note. This was like...
No, I wanted it. I wanted it. I remember even being in court for like really petty stuff. Like I got caught for writing, like I said that I wrote dolphins are humans too and pretended I was like an environmentalist, but I got caught in the city doing tags on a wall and I was in court for it. Because in the Melbourne Magistrates Court, they have the gallery and where, so anybody can go in there and sit in there. But a lot of criminals go in there just to hang out. And I was so ashamed because they thought I was just this dumb, like petty, whereas actually I was doing all this quite, like, it was reasonably like quite audacious crime in my head. And I was like, oh, I'm not getting the respect. They think I'm just this little loser. So... I really enjoyed and wanted that respect from older criminals, which is, yeah, it's just bizarre. But a lot of it comes from the area.
You were smoking from an early age, but, you know, you have to buy the cigarettes.
Yes, sometimes, but hard to steal, but, yeah, mostly buy.
Yeah. How far did you go to try and procure cigarettes?
Well, I took desperate measures when I once wrote a note to my dad's signature was too hard to forge, so I forged my mum's, but I wrote a note saying that she'd been playing netball and she'd injured her leg. And could you please, I can't make it to the shop, so I've sent my son and I'd like some Super King Super Mild, please. Here's my $6.50 or whatever.
And you'd written that with your 10-year-old hand.
I'd written that with my 10-year-old handwriting. Although I did have pretty good handwriting. The one thing I did have was like, you know, neat, small, really neat handwriting.
And what happened when you handed that over to the shopkeeper?
He just looked at me. He's like, you're the kid I see every day who comes in and gets lollies. Like, what the hell are you doing here, you know? And he just sort of just looked at me and just sort of said, piss off, you know, and just kind of shooed me away.
When were you finally kicked out of school? What was the thing that got you kicked out of school for good?
I remember I had started to get into sort of to be disruptive in primary school when I was, but then it was almost like this progression where I couldn't handle being in the general educational environment. So year seven, I got kicked out of at the end of the year at Simmons. I went to Williamstown Bayside. They asked me to leave after 2 years. Then I went to Lionel Hall Community School and I managed to get kicked out of a community school. And I tried one last time at Caulfield Community School and I never went. I left after a couple of months. So, yeah, I left school officially at about 16.
Did you hate school?
The one memory, okay, if I have one positive memory of my whole schooling is in year seven, I had this teacher called Mr. De Cruz. He was Portuguese. He was like small, had a big head. I remember he had a really large head. And I always used to mess up in class. And during English, he said, Dominic, we've all written stories. What's your story say? You know, why don't you get up and read it out? And for the first deep down, I was so secretly so happy that someone, he'd rec, and I got up and I read out my, we were just like written these little short stories and I read it out and I was so happy just to have someone seen what I really enjoyed, which was words and constructing sentence and just, yeah, I guess writing. I did like it. And so he recognized that in me, but everything else, I didn't get any, I couldn't sit still. And obviously later on when I was in my 30s, it made sense when I got an ADHD diagnosis. But I didn't know any of that. And that was, yeah, so my whole schooling was disrupted. And
you said you wanted to be a criminal.
Yes.
That you wanted to be a writer as well. Those two worlds have overlapped quite a lot in the course of history. You know, William Burroughs being one example of that. And
yes.
Certainly drug taking and writing. Like,
yes.
Did you have an image of yourself as a writer as well as a criminal or not? Or just criminal?
No, this is the thing. When I mentioned the writing, it was more so that there's someone had recognised that, had seen me, had heard me for who I was. The writing aspect, I didn't really take writing seriously until I was in my sort of late 20s. I didn't really see any future for me in regular society.
But,
I didn't.
So at that stage, you didn't imagine yourself?
No, definitely not. No, that came a lot later.
There was a form of writing you did take to, though, at an early age, which was graffiti. Tell me how you would actually paint graffiti, how you'd actually go about where you'd go to do that.
Where you go. I mean, it's funny because it's, the irony is that I'm so, I can't stand, I'm so adverse to hierarchical structures in conventional society, but yet within graffiti, it's the most hierarchical structure. So it's so intense. So you say, for example, when you're starting out, you're called a toy, you're naturally your shit. You're doing pieces in the drains, you're doing tags on wooden fences, you're doing this really low-level lame stuff, which is just a natural part of how you develop. And then over time, you'll start to develop a hand style, which is, say, for example, you'll get markers and you'll develop how your tag will be, how it will look. And that over time, you'll pick a word and that word becomes what you invest your style in and what you make. And you want to be known for that.
When you say this, are you kind of conscious of other people who are tagging around the place and where you fit into that hierarchy?
It fits. Everything else is blocked out. there's like a myopia. You don't see the real world. All you look, your whole vision is just is concentrated around graffiti and looking at walls, looking at rooftops, looking at trains, everything. It consumes your whole life. If you want to go all the way in, you can't actually do anything else, which is why that world has, it sort of scoops up all these damaged individuals or all these people, because it provides kind of almost like a safe place in which to destroy things collectively together, like a collective aggression, like it's anger-based.
And are there other taggers who put you in your place, like, or punch you in the head or something?
Yeah, I've been in fights, because it's natural to come up against enemies. Like if you're from the western suburbs, you'll naturally hate people from the south or southeastern, or like you have, there's natural hierarchies within certain suburbs. Like it's incredibly tribal. And even to this day, I still find myself, that's how my vision, like I still look for it. Even though I haven't done graffiti in years and years, I still have that trained perspective to look for it, even though I haven't done graffiti for so long.
You would do graffiti on moving train carriages. Tell me how you would actually go and do that, how that would actually work.
There's a few ways to do it. I guess my favourite place to do it was a place called Spencer Street Yard. So it's where the trains lay up when they're not in use. So the trains would be side by side next to each other. In this instance, there was two trains and they sit there overnight. And there's security, but oftentimes the security has to sort of walk and do their rounds around the train yard, which can take a long time. So you would cut through the cyclone fence, and then you would run across to where the trains are both laid up. And then you would ideally get in the aisle so that you can't be seen from either side, and you paint in there. And yeah, you just get the job done and get out of there. And hopefully the train will run the next day. And then you'll see it running, and that's the pure joy. Like I remember doing panels and then sitting on the, like in the train, like with next to the panel, and just being just like a, just so happy just to know that my panel was running in the public's like transport system, and I was sitting next to it.
Were you doing tagging on a passenger train while it's actually on its run as well?
Well, it has to be stopped to do it, but yeah, whilst it's running, yeah, you do it like things called run-ups, where the train would pull in for a moment, and then you'd run up and tag the outside of the train, and then it would take off. And you do that in a few different places.
And what kind of insane stunts had you tried to pull while doing that?
Well, it's more about exposure. It's more about like where you're doing it during the day. You're totally exposed. Like you do it where there's a sort of a freeway can see you. Houses can see you. And so you get lots of chases. I've been chased heaps of times.
There must be a whole lot of people seeing you doing this stuff, you know, stealing, shoplifting, tagging, all that stuff. And you'd generate a whole lot of hatred for that antisocial behaviour. Were you aware of that? Did you care about it, or did you kind of glory in it, or
the people hating?
Yeah.
A lot of it was to do with anger and hate. I had a lot of hate in my heart, I think, at the time. Because I wasn't thinking about, like when you think about it, you can't engage in these behaviours. Like a lot of the thieving, it was very personal. Like I would steal people's like wallets and their personal belongings, and I would take and just throw it away. I would take the money and throw it away. Like I felt like society kind of owed me something, or like, because I was cast out. I felt like I was a bit cast out from a young age, like outside the school system. I couldn't really work. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And so I teamed up with a bunch of, you know, other dysfunctional kids who were also full of hate. There's variations of hate, but a lot of it is turned inwards on yourself.
How close did you get to being busted? Tell me about the day when you came extremely close to being busted on a train.
On a train? So we were doing loops, which is when you do tags in the inside of the train with markers. And I was with my friend Frank, and we were doing this something called the Heidelberg Express. So it runs express from Flinders Street to Clifton Hill, then Clifton Hill to Heidelberg. So between Flinders Street and Clifton Hill, you've got six or so stations to tag as much as you can on the inside of the train as possible. And about a few stations in, when we'd already done heaps of tags on the train, over the loudspeaker, the driver's like, "Oh, you've been spotted. The cops have been called." And we're like, "Oh, shit, what do we do now?" So lucky for us, the train pulled into to Clifton Hill. And we forced the doors, you know, so before the train, so with the police were already, you could see them, they were already like driving up to parallel to the station. You could, so they were almost in the area. And then we forced open the doors, tumbled out and just ran down the platform, jumped down onto the rocks and then ran away. And the cops had sort of come onto the platform and were running after us, but they were clumsy. They kind of couldn't get down onto the track rocks in time and we got out of there. But there's other times I've been, I got the chase in upfield, and upfield is not a nice place to be stuck. I remember just hiding in long grass and then climbing fences and getting my jacket stuck on the fence. Like I was sort of clung to it like a bug, got out of my jacket. And then there were dogs. They send dogs out to look for you, and dogs were nearby and they managed not to see me. And I got the first train home and it was covered in paint.
Afterwards, would you and your friends go, wow, that was the most fantastic experience?
It's incredible. There's nothing like it. I mean, that's why I was so drawn to it, because of the risk and because of the feeling. It's like, and also that's why so much of it goes hand in hand with substance abuse, because it's such a high adrenaline and a high, you know, extreme activity that when you stop it, you sort of go home afterwards and you're just sitting there buzzing, like your body is sort of like, and then you'll crash. But before the crash, you kind of usually get high again, like you smoke bongs or do other drugs. And because, yeah, it's not a natural thing to do to your body again and again and again, that high adrenaline all the time. And it's essentially for no reward. You don't get anything out of it. You don't get any money. You don't get any, all you're doing it for is fame from a small group of people. You're doing it for that fame and that respect within a real sort of subculture.
This put you on a Crime Stoppers list. What do you remember? What do you remember about seeing that for the first time?
Oh, pure joy. Because I used to have these plastic triangles, like in the early 2000s, they'd put them at stations and then have the crime committed by the person and the picture of the offender.
What, they captured you from that train that day?
Yeah, and me and Sleepy, no, we weren't on the train, we were on the platform, so that a camera had taken a photo or a still image of us running down the platform away from the police that time at Clifton Hill. So you could see both of us sort of mid-run. I'd sort of tried to cover up my face, but you could see the top of my face. Frank, you could see he hadn't covered himself up. He was clearly visible. And I went to Clifton Hill like 2 weeks later, and I saw it, and I just couldn't. It was just pure joy. I was like, this is exactly what I want. But then, obviously, thinking back on it, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Why would I care so much about getting my face and my crime on this tiny little statue?
Tell me about the first proper fight you got into as a teenager, as a 16-year-old at a party.
Yeah, it was a real sort of clunky affair. I'd gone to the party just to steal. I used to go to the party just to steal wallets or belongings. I get to the bag room.
Did you know anyone there at the party, or did you just saw there was a party going on?
I think we knew, like, we'd heard of it from a friend of a friend. It wasn't really, so I didn't know anybody. So as soon as we walked in, I saw, like, there was a wallet on the bookshelf. I grabbed it and put it down my pants, and we were about to walk out, but we got seen. And then these two guys came out and sort of confronted me and my friend. And then at the time, I hadn't really, like, I'd been in a few like schoolyard scuffles, and because I played football, I was used to a bit of rough and tumble, but never really thrown an actual punch.
And you're not a tall guy either. You're not a big guy.
No, I'm a little guy. Yeah. But that worked to my advantage in this sense, because they were sort of, they blocked the entrance, so we couldn't really get out. And then whilst they were sort of asking for the wallet back, someone had sort of yelled out something, and in that moment, I kind of just thought, fuck it, and just lunged and punched. You can still see it now. I'm missing a knuckle on my, like, I've got one, two, three knuckles, but the fourth knuckle on my right hand is gone. It's like being pushed back, and it like actually broke my own knuckle on. So it was a real, like, a coward and terrible. Yeah, like, it was just so lame. And then the whole sort of point of that was getting the wallet, and I only had $20 in it, and grabbed it and chucked the wallet away. But, and then as I got older, it became more, I guess, more normalized, to the point where even, like, it was crazy. Like, in my 30s, I got in a lot, like two or three really full on street fights, where I got sort of, one of them I got kicked unconscious. Another one, I was on King Street, and this guy, like, he was, you know, wearing shorts, you know, bald, 40, like, he apparently had a knife. And apparently, like, there was a few blackout moments, but I remember waking up, well, not waking up, but coming, being aware that, you know, I was cops dragging us off, and then seeing him being taken away by an ambulance, and then the cops being like, oh, yeah, you got him, yeah. They were kind of saying, oh, he did a good job, because apparently he'd attacked a few people. And anyway, it was all this kind of, I think a lot of these behaviors were fighting for existence in a version of me that I just wanted to be different. But yet I'd done these behaviors for so long. We're talking, you know, almost 15, 20 years up at this point. And I didn't know how to change. I didn't know what to do.
After you've been in those fights, how do you feel afterwards?
In the beginning, there's a sense of pride, a sense of achievement. But then immediately afterwards, it's just miserable. You wake up, you've got blood on you, you know, so yeah, it's just all miserable. I mean, I think I did it. There was one more fight after that, and then I got really badly sort of knocked unconscious and was knocked out for a good half an hour. And I haven't gotten into any more fights, which is good.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
When you moved to Elsternwick, you hooked up with a crew called CDP. What was CDP, and what did CDP stand for?
So CDP was a graph crew.
Graffiti crew.
Graffiti crew. That stood for a few things. There was Crime Does Pay, Criminal Damage Posse, and Crime Drugs Power. The leader of the gang was this crazy guy called, I don't say his name, but his tag was Macho, and he was so volatile. One of the first times I met him, he was capsicum sprayed outside a petrol station and thrown in the back of the divvy van. There's this famous clip of him in a nice polo shirt smoking ice on a packed train. But he was our leader, and there was about six of us in it. And we were just really active painters in the area from about 2002 to about 2005. And of the five or six of us, two are dead, three. Only me and this other guy, Shane, are alive, or the rest of the people are dead or in jail. So there was a real crime crossover.
You mentioned that leader was doing ice. Is that what led you into taking ice as well?
Well, it's funny because it's at the time ice was almost exotic. It wasn't really a thing. There was... like we're still sort of old amphetamines, but then around 2003, 2004, it sort of suddenly was everywhere. And I guess that was to do with the changing drug taking styles in society and what was around and what wasn't. But so essentially, when you get something as potent as that, it's hard to go back to something less. But then it fluctuated, like the drug market, it flooded the streets, and then it kind of stopped. And then in my mid-20s, I really picked it up. And just ran with it. And just the level of intensity that is, everything is crystallized, everything is clear, everything is powerful, and it leads you to, so you stay awake for, say, a point of high-quality meth will keep you awake, it can keep you awake for 24 hours, any more than that, and you're looking at, so I would stay awake sometimes from Friday to Sunday, and then I'd go on stealing binges as well, because what it would do is it would lead me into other behaviors. So I would, because it was like a coping mechanism for, I guess, things that I'd experienced when I was younger, I would smoke ice to obliterate myself. And then whilst obliterated, I would go and engage in secretive stuff. Like I wouldn't tell my friends, but I'd go off to these sort of gay sex lounges, and I'd be high, and I would sort of explore myself there. And then I would go and commit crimes whilst high. And it was sort of this perfect gateway for me to continue this sort of secretive, high intense behavior. And I was juggling a lot of secrets at the time as well. Because when I was 17, I said to my friend at the time, I said, and when I told him I was turning 17, he laughed at me and he said, how could you, because I was so little at the time. And so I just lied and actually said, so when I was 17, I lied and said I was 16. So I never got to, so then I even got a fake ID made to say that I was 18, when I was actually 19. So I was always living a year younger than I actually was to make, because I was carrying all this deception. And it was just got to the point where it was so overwhelming. What's interesting about addiction is you need it. Like you seek it out, you know, and that's why a lot of people don't become addicted, because they don't have this need to fill the void. I really loved it. I wanted it.
You mentioned that you're also going, while under the influence, going into gay sex lounges.
Yeah.
Are you gay?
No.
Why were you going there?
Well, it's a wild time because I didn't know what was going on. I thought it was like a classic sexual identity thing. I mean, I can connect it to something that happened to me when I was younger. I was 13 at the time, and because I hadn't had any sexual experiences before, that behaviour then led me to think that that was a kind of a normal way of interacting. So I sought out these high intense gay sexual experiences, because that was the first experience that I'd had as a very young person. And that set me off on this really sort of dark path where I wasn't able to explore my sexuality in a healthy way. It really sort of, and it led, and then it all sort of, this perfect storm happened, because it was like all these high risk behaviors sort of were all coming together, and so the drugs and the sex and the fight, like, and the steal, it was all just happening, and it just totally consumed me. I was just overwhelmed by this kind of stuff, because my self esteem was so low at the time. I didn't think it was that strange to have these sexual encounters with strange men in strange places. It was just, that's kind of what I knew at the time. And only throughout loads of therapy, development, medications and making progress in my life, I've now been able to realise what so much of that behaviour was about.
Did you know why you were doing what you were doing back then?
I had no idea, no. It was absolute torment. It was just, I never wanted to be still. I never wanted to stop moving. And when this one time when my mum said, when I was like 17, she said, yeah, you're like a rolling stone that gathers no moss. And I said, watch me be the stone that rolls the most and gathers all moss at all. Like, I wanted to be the most extreme. In my head, I was like, okay, watch me attach myself to nothing and no one and anonymity and darkness and being alone. Watch me be the most alone, the most hate-filled, the most aggressive person. I used to have this mantra in my head where I would say, I'm more angry than you. Like, that's kind of what would get me kind of through things.
And was that like an adventure, like going to the moon or something? like to be a kind of an astronaut of the world or around the world or something? I don't know.
Well, I guess you are entering into like upside down. That's a parallel kind of universe in a way, you are, because you're going deep underground. You're going into places that are for the most part really dark. There's no love there, and you're not really going to find genuine connection there.
Did you think there was love in the world?
Not really, no. I didn't know what it was.
Did you think it didn't exist? It was hypocrisy, or did you think that I just haven't found it, or what?
I didn't believe that love. Like, I thought it was a big scam.
Did you feel loved by your parents?
Well, yes, I did. I did, of course I did, but it was...
Because they were tearing their hair out.
It was interesting, because it was a practical love. So there was always, this is what has, I guess, kept me from going all the way into the deep end, was that there was always food, there was always a place, you know, a place to go home to. And a lot of the friends who had more significant dysfunctional home lives would come over to my house to have something to eat, to relax a bit. So yeah, of course there was love, but it was... Like, because my parents are quite, like, it's almost like to save themselves, they had to repress their own emotions.
So at 20 years old, you found yourself in front of a judge as an adult for the first time.
For the first time, yeah.
You've been going there as a juvenile before.
I've been as a juvenile, yeah, many times as a juvenile.
And what was different about it this time?
Just how much more formal, and it seemed much more serious. Like, I was there on charges of, you know, I was saying before, it was about... just tagging on a wall in the city. I was drunk and I'd been spotted by a couple of cops and they'd grabbed me. And anyway, but like, I was just my dad at the time and he'd like dressed up for the occasion, and it felt quite significant. But because I wanted to still be that, you know, to show that I didn't care, I remember the judge was talking to me and I just sort of smirked at him. And I said, oh, you know, you better learn to do, you know, you're heading this particular direction, young man. And I just sort of smirked at him, and then he just He sort of, you know, dropped the spectacles, lowered them down his nose and just sort of unleashed at me and said, you know, where you're going, I've seen so many young men like you go in exactly the same direction that you're going. And if you don't learn, you better learn how to fight, because you're going to have to learn how to fight in jail, because that smirk's going to get wiped right off. And he said that to me. And I just, it was like it, for the first time, all this behavior, all these years had sort of hit me as, okay, this is real. It was sort of real for the first time. I remember losing, like I kind of went pale, because he made me think that he was going to send me to jail. And then he stopped and then he said, no, I'm going to record a conviction against you. But next time you're going, you know, that's it, you go to jail.
But you'd always wanted to be a criminal.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
You'd never wanted to be a criminal that went to jail.
No. Well, that's the thing. At that age, so I've been doing what I've been doing for about a good 5 years now. And at the same time, I was kind of exhausted. I was burnt out. So that idea of becoming a criminal, it was still in me, but it didn't. It ran its course in a short expanse of time, but a very intense expanse of time. And by that age, by 20, I'd experienced a lot. Like, I'd done a lot of things to my body, to my, like, to my soul. And I wanted out. I didn't know what I wanted, but I wanted something else.
You were getting sick of the life?
I was sick, but I was also physically sick. Like, I was in hospital a lot, and life was very miserable. Like, I wasn't enjoying myself. I was, all the things that, like, and I was, I stopped doing, I'd stopped graph, I stopped doing graffiti as well. And I moved, so the big move was I moved to the country with my mum and dad, who'd moved to Wonthaggi 6 months earlier. And I said to myself, okay, I'll get a proper job. I'll try and commit less crime, and I'll save up money to go overseas. And I managed to do that. I got a job at Green Court, like doing, which is run by Parks Victoria, where I went out into the bush and, you know, recognized local flora and fauna and protected plant species. And I did all these things. It was so different to what I was doing. And I worked in the chicken shop, and I worked in a takeaway shop, and I saved up money and bought a ticket to London, and then pissed off for a year.
What were you like in London when you got there and no one knew who you were? No one knew anything about your background? No one?
Yeah, I loved it. It was also a strange time. I started to wear turtlenecks and long coats and weird caps and, you know, that weird. I look back on that now as a strange time. But
the uniform of a bohemian.
Well, yeah.
Is this the repressed writer, or was that too obvious?
Yeah, I don't know. I think...
Is that really obvious
thing? Because the whole time I was going to film, I was going to the cinema and... the Prince Charles Cinema, I think, off Leicester Square. Yeah, and it showed a lot of old films. And, yeah, I think then I was sort of, I did realise that, hang on, I did want to write, but I didn't apply myself. I was still got up to similar behaviours over there. Because once you do these things for a long period of time, it's incredibly, incredibly hard and long road to see another way. I was used to it.
Do you think that was what you were worth?
Very low. I didn't care. I mean, to be honest, I didn't care whether I lived or died most of the time, especially when I was young. I didn't really give a shit.
So you came back to Australia and you met Ro, who's your partner now.
Yes.
Yeah. How did you meet Ro?
Okay, Cupid. So the old dating website, I had it on my desktop. And then, so yeah, we met up and her friend convinced her to go on a date with me because he wasn't sure. And then from there, we sort of went on a couple more dates and then started hanging out. But then it was, I was seeing other girls at the time, and I had still quite a chaotic lifestyle.
So you were on again, off again with her.
Yeah.
And then at the age of 31, just before your 32nd birthday.
Yes,
you
yes.
did that thing that I mentioned right at the start. You leapt off
yes.
an apartment balcony up on the third floor. What was the thought that propelled you towards that?
I think what it mainly was that at the time, again, it was like that feeling of nothing will ever change. My life is just this mess. Even though I have this person who loves me, the context was that we'd been out with one of her friends and I thought that they were like having a thing together, and they weren't. It was in my delusion. I wasn't even on drugs at all. So we lived on the third floor and we pulled up in a cab and got out and started walking, and I just started running. And I don't remember any of it.
You don't remember any of this?
I remember the lead up to it. I remember running. I remember jumping. And then I waking up in the emergency room, and I was high on ketamine, and they were snapping my fingers back into place. And I was wearing like a back brace type thing around my waist to keep my, because I'd shattered my hip and broken many bones in my jaw and both my wrists. And I had to sort of, okay, I didn't die, right? What do I do now? So I had to have this choice. I had to have where there was nowhere else for me to go. I couldn't go any lower. I couldn't, there was nowhere else for me to go. So I was in the trauma ward for a couple of weeks and then I did some rehab and came home. But that's when I started to address my mental health issues. I went to a psychiatrist. I ended up having a diagnosis of adult ADHD and bipolar in it. And since then I've been going to intensive therapy and doing all this work. But throughout that whole time, Ro has been this incredibly like stabilizing influence in my life. Like she's been incredible. And then the amazing thing is that, so it was when I was 21, I had like a setback where we broke up and I moved to an apartment by myself, started doing the same things again, started using drugs, started taking risks, I thought, hang on, I'm just so alone here. I'm just like by myself doing the same things. And I thought, hang on, there's someone who loves me and I know I love too. So why not like try and, like, because to me, obviously, because, you know, love was still an alien concept to me. I'd had relationships, but it was never, there was no fear. Like I had these intense experiences, feelings, but never any this feeling of love. And Ro, for the first time, I had a feeling of like this kind of deep connection. And so I wanted to make it work and we got back together. And then almost a year later, you know, our son was born. And from there, it's just been this sort of beautiful development where I've sort of been, he's been growing and his energy's been sort of flourishing and I've also been developing. And so it's this great kind of, I'm just coming all the way back around after so many years of having a life that I didn't think I would ever have.
You now say, right, that you see the kind of straight life now and being a good father as a kind of a risk, but a more entertaining risk now in a way.
Yeah.
Tell me, how do you see that?
Well, it's because it's so alien to me. Just a regular life where you get up at the same time and you have regular meals and you have a job. Like, well, I don't have a job because I write, but that's a job. But anyway, and I have responsibilities and I have obligations. And to me, because it's so alien, it has the same effect as somebody who is doing those things and wants to take a risk that, like, do graffiti or do crime. It's the same thing for me, but looking at a 9-to-5 lifestyle as a high risk activity because I've done the opposite of that for so long.
It's stepping into a strange new world.
A strange new world and a strange safe new world. And to me, safety was always risky. Something safe was always a risk for me. I couldn't trust it because I had a lot of trust issues and I didn't want to be vulnerable and I didn't. So I had to sort of come out of myself and be, you know, and access all those parts of myself that I'd sort of compartmentalized and locked away. And I had to sort of, you know, unpack all that. Because my whole thing about being a father was to stop that intergenerational trauma that happened. My great grandparents, mum, dad, and then me and my brother. So I thought, hang on, I want to be that stopgap in that intergenerational trauma cycle. And I feel like I'm doing okay.
After you came out of hospital, you discovered you'd won a writing fellowship issued by the State Library of Victoria. What did that provide for you?
Well, that was not serendipitous, but it was almost at a time where there was, I'd survived the hospital, you know, the leap, and I was like, what am I going to do now? And then I realised that a week prior to jumping off, you know, the third floor, I'd submitted an application for a fellowship at the State Library of Victoria. And then I found out when I got home that I'd won this fellowship, which gave me an office in the State Library and access to all their archives. And it's quite prestigious. It was to come up basically about an aspect of Victorian history. So I had this idea of writing about parts of my experience as an aspect of Victorian history. And so I got the fellowship and then I thought, what do I do now? I've got to write nonfiction. I've got to get down to work. And that was the impetus 5 years ago or 6 years ago now. That then became Excitable Boy. That's where it started.
And was that an easy thing or a hard thing to go into a room and just start to write like that?
Well, that was, for me, it was completely alien. I remember having like a board where I had a card up on the board. I'd write down these sort of palm cards, these sticky notes, and I'd put them on the wall. And all I had up there was, just tell the truth. That's all I had up there, this big sort of massive space, just tell the truth. But I was so lucky that at the time I met who would become my mentor, Guy Rundle, the journalist. author, and he essentially, we linked up together, and it's been an incredible relationship because he is, first of all, he taught me the craft of nonfiction, and over time that our relationship has developed into a friendship, and without him, I wouldn't have gotten to be where I am today.
Having written all that out and confronted it all, does it feel like you can kind of hold it in your hand now?
Well, that's the crazy thing. It's this massive, I mean, it's cliche, but it is a closed chapter of my life. It's a literal closed chapter of the all these years of experience, which I now can sort of exactly close and, you know, ideally move on from. And so the next phase of my life would be finding a way to write about new experiences, less, you know, traumatic experiences.
Where do you put all that manic energy into now?
Well, I do.
Aside from writing, I mean.
Well, I do a fair bit of exercise. But also, unfortunately, I still have maladaptive sort of coping mechanisms. Like I drink a lot, but I exercise. When I do exercise, I do boxing and I run and I do sort of hit like intense workouts. But yeah, I have a lot of manic energy. But I'm quite well medicated as well. So I've had to make a few sacrifices in terms of instead of having a highly elevated mood, I am now on sort of a mood stabilizer, which sort of just flattens me out a bit, but makes life more livable, less chaotic. I can make clearer decisions. I can be there for my family. My priorities are completely different now, and I'm just adjusting to that. Because who says, what's that writer, that maybe it was Jonathan Franzen, and he said to write something new or to create new work, it's like he had to divorce his wife and move. But it's almost like the opposite for me. It's like I had to find a new life for then to produce new work. So like Helen Garner also says that too, that based off the persona, which persona are you going to write from? Which version of I is going to be the one that you write your new material from? Because you have to... I don't want to write from the same... I'm not the same excitable boy now. I'm a less excitable man, really. Still excitable, but less so, less extreme.
That's the sequel, A Less Excitable Man.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
That's been completely fascinating speaking with you, and thank you for your honesty. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Dominic.
Oh, it's been great, Richard. Thanks so much.
Dominic Gordon's memoir is called Excitable Boy, Essays on Risk. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.